Happy Friday, everyone. I hope you're having a great one and look forward to a great weekend. I want to encourage you to get to church this Lord's Day. Everyone needs a home congregation where they can worship and fellowship and praise and pray and sing and encourage and study and serve in all the different aspects of Christianity. If you don't have a home church, go out, do the work, find a place, and become part of that localized family. If you're actively looking right now for a place like that, and you're within driving distance of the Elkhart East building, please come check us out and see whether or not we might become that place that you'll call home. Want to say thank you to those who are supporting Into the Word financially. We can't stay on this radio station without that. So if there's any of you that would like to help in that effort, it's easy enough to do. Just write down the contact information you hear at the end of every program. Then you can send your one-time or ongoing gift of any amount to that address, and it will help pay for the radio broadcast fees. Thanks for taking care of that. Let's turn our Bibles to Genesis chapter number 12, where we're going to pick up at verse 17, the story of Abram and Sarai in Egypt. Now, the reason they're in Egypt is because the weather pattern of the Med watering Canaan, the promised land, has failed. And so Egypt is fed water-wise by a different weather pattern. And so this is one of the reasons it's a much more stable food supply. And that comes into the big story in the last section of the book of Genesis, the story about Joseph. While they were on their way to Egypt, Abram told his wife Sarai, I need you to go along with this idea that you're my sister rather than my wife, because I think it's possible that they're going to look at how beautiful you are. And she was. And some of these powerful people down here are just going to simply kill me so that they can have you. So let's go with the idea that you're my younger sister, and anybody that has an interest in you is going to have to go through me. That is, they'll have to treat me well in order to get my permission as your older brother, as the patriarch of this whole crew here, to get married to you. And that'll postpone it long enough that we can get back out of the country and back to Canaan before we get into any trouble. Well, it all backfired because it was the Egyptian pharaoh, the number one guy of all the associated regions of Lower Egypt, particularly around the Delta, that decided that he wanted to get married to Sarai, and he didn't ask permission. He just assumed. So he gives a great big dowry price to Abram and takes Sarai to the palace, and they start making wedding preparations. He starts making wedding preparations. And I kind of closed up last time with the fact that Abram, he's in a mess because there's not anything he can do about it. He was already afraid of some of the power players in Egypt killing him and taking her. Well, now the biggest power player of them all has her. And she, no doubt, is also quite upset because she's already married to the man that she grew up with as a half-brother. And now he's her husband. And even though they haven't been able to have any kids, they're still in love with each other and dedicated to each other. And here she is facing the possibility of getting married to some guy that she's not interested in. Well, in a circumstance like that, the only thing that you can hope will happen is that God will intervene and make up for your bad choices. And that is exactly what happened. Genesis 12, 17. But he who is afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. Now, it does not tell us any specificity at this point as to what God did in order to get Pharaoh's attention. But we have another story, weirdly and sadly, where Abraham tries this again and gets into the same sort of pickle, where we are told what God does. And that is basically he shuts down the ability of all females, both human females and animal females, to get pregnant and have babies. And that's going to take over a period of time, but it would get your attention, wouldn't it? And so I think it's possible that a similar thing happened here. And then the Pharaoh would have perhaps had a dream, like will later happen in the other story. And God tells him, hey, there's a problem here. She's already married. You need to let her go back to her husband. And so that is likely to have happened between verses 17 and 18, is God strikes Pharaoh's household with something that gets his attention, and then God does a follow-up dream saying, hey, the problem is you got another man's wife that you plan on marrying. Now verse 18. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you have done to me? Why didn't you tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say, she's my sister, so that I took her as my wife? So he is correctly upset with Abram, because Abram misled him. He didn't tell him a lie, because she is his sister, half-sister. But he misled him into thinking that she was on the market, so to speak, that she was an available woman to be married, and the Pharaoh had assumed that he would want to agree to such a powerful person as himself engaging her for marriage, and took her home. And so now that's why he's in this trouble. So he blames Abram, and then he reverses the situation, because that's what God wants. Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. Get out of here. Now, we do not know how long this story went on. It seems as if it may have been several months that this happened. We know in some circumstances, the women who were betrothed would go for an entire year before the actual wedding. So I suppose it's possible that we may have even had close to a year that this circumstance was going on. But we know that when God pulls the plug on it, when God brings it to an end, that Pharaoh says to Abram, get out. I want you to leave. You cause me trouble. Verse 20, Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. So it doesn't take anything from Abram. Probably, again, God warned him in a dream, don't do that. Don't do any reprisals. But it seems as though Pharaoh told his men, please take this whole crew, this whole Bedouin tent city led by Abram to our border with Canaan, and tell him, there's the highway, go. And so we come to chapter number 13. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him into the Negev. So the Negev, again, is that northern part of the Sinai Desert. It's the transition place in Canaan between the fairly green, lush area of the majority of Canaan and the drier area of the Sinai Peninsula. And from here, we are told that he's going to go back to Bethel, back to his second encampment. But before that, we were reminded of this, verse 2. Now, Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold. So he has a ton of stuff. And that shouldn't, again, be surprising because this whole line that we've seen of this family from, we could start probably with Eber, you know, the namesake of the Hebrew language in the time of the Tower of Babel. Eber's line all the way down to Terah and now Abram. Each successive generation accumulates things and then passes that on to the next generation. And so each generation, thanks to good management among those people and the blessing of God as well, I think, gets progressively more and more and more wealthy. Because effectively, this Bedouin lifestyle, this tent city, it is like a growing town that just keeps moving around. Abram is the mayor of this town, if you will. So he is very rich. He's got a lot of stuff that he's accumulating. So verse 3, he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel, or Luz at this time is the name of this city, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning between Bethel and Ai, to the place where he'd made an altar at the first. And there Abram called upon the name of He Who Is. Now, He Who is the divine name that Moses has been introduced to, and he is plugging it into this story at this point to remind his people, the Israelis coming out of Egypt, that this is the same God that got us out of Egypt. This is the same creator of Genesis 1, 2, and chapters 1 and 2. This is the same God that is promising us the promised land. So Abram goes back to his second site and worships God there and takes back up his Bedouin lifestyle, grazing his flocks, no doubt paying for the grazing and water rights. But then this is what we hear next. We don't know how long it takes, but eventually. Verse 5, Lot, who went with Abram, he's his nephew, and Lot answers to Abram as the patriarch of this crew. Lot also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. So it's like having two big tent cities jammed together. And the area around that is being used for grazing land is being grazed by their huge flocks. And so there's a problem. So there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. So their employees are having arguments. Hey, this area is our grassland. Find your own grassland. Or this area is our watering zone. This is our well. Go find your own. Go make your own well. And so there's tension between the two. We are reminded by Moses. Actually, it was his Israelis that are being reminded of this. At that time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were dwelling in the land. So these guys are just sojourners. They are just immigrants that are living among the existing inhabitants. So verse number 8, Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife between you and me, between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. This is his appeal to basically say, look, we're in this together. We're strangers in this land. We're the only Semites in a Hamite region, because that is one of the things we learned from the Table of Nations back in chapter 10. The Canaanites come from the Ham line, while the Israelis and Abram is the beginning of the Israeli story, they're Shemites. And so they are the out-of-place immigrants. And so he's saying, let's not do this. We're in this together. Verse number 9, is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, then I'll go to the right. Or if you take the right hand, I'll go to the left. So Abram is so gracious here. He and Lot are probably fairly close to the same age. My guess would be that Lot's a little bit younger than him. Abram started out this story when he came to Canaan at 75. He may be 76, maybe 77 by this point in the story. But Lot is probably 50s, 60s, something like that. And so Abram says to the junior member of this patriarchal society, I'm going to let you choose. That's kind and compassionate. So Lot lifted up his eyes, and he saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere, like the garden of he who is, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This was before he who is destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So that's an important thing for Moses to make clear here. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah has not yet happened, which changed the topography and the climate of the lower Jordan Valley. Because Sodom and Gomorrah, I believe, were probably located in the south basin area of the Dead Sea. This whole region of the lower Jordan Valley was referred to as Sidim, the place of fields. It was a major agricultural zone, very, very prosperous. And not just that, but the upper basin of the Dead Sea produced bitumen, big bubbles of this oil-like substance. In fact, it's probably stuff that was escaping from the oil reserves underneath the region of the Dead Sea. This would bubble up, and it would be harvested. It'd be collected, and it could be used for a lot of different products, not just simply waterproofing, but cosmetics and medicine and all sorts of things. Very expensive. And so this whole region of the lower Jordan Valley looked like the Garden of Eden, the stories of the Garden of Eden, very beautiful. Or like the Delta region, which they'd just seen in Egypt, very green, very lush, very productive. And so that's what Lot is looking at, is the beauty of that. He and Abram, being based out of the area by Bethel and Ai, would have been able to look down into the Jordan Valley from their vantage point and see all of this. And so being given the chance to choose, Lot, verse 11, chose for himself all the Jordan Valley. And then Lot journeyed east. So the problem is solved. Abram is going to stay up on the ridgeline where they've been at. Lot is going to go a few miles to the east, about 12, 15 miles to the east, and go down into the bountiful Jordan Valley. And I'm going to remind you again, if you see pictures of the Jordan Valley now, it is dry, except right up next to the Jordan River. Don't think of that in this story. You need to realize that that is, that dryness of today is a result of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. It changed everything down in that valley. Lot goes down there. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. So when he went down into the Jordan Valley from where they were at, up by Bethel and Ai, that would have taken him a little bit north of where Jericho is. And so all of this is very lush at this time. So he goes southward, which would have taken him probably to the north basin of the Dead Sea, still very lush all around there at this time probably. And then he goes down into the south basin area, which at that time, I believe, was the location of the five cities of the plain. Sodom and Gomorrah are the best known of them. Adma and Zeboim are the other two that end up being destroyed. The last one was Bela, which gets known as Zoar after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And we are pretty sure we know where Zoar is now. It is on the southeast corner of what used to be the south basin of the Dead Sea. It's the only place that survived the destruction of the cities. And so, for his own purposes, Lot heads down by the big cities. And he's grazing his animals out on the different grazing areas, probably paying the people of Sodom and Gomorrah for that privilege. But eventually, he's going to end up living inside Sodom itself. And that's because he's a very wealthy man and can afford to be inside the city while his people, his employees, are outside the city taking care of his animals for him. Now, that's a problem, though. Verse 13, Moses reminds us, "Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against he who is." And we will eventually talk about why they were such horrible sinners. And it's not just the sexuality. Sexuality issues are part of the symptoms that come out of the sinful attitude that they had. And we have some testimony from the book of Ezekiel, I believe, that will help us understand the sinful attitude of these Sodom, Gomorrah, Zeboim, Adma, and Bela occupants. Verse number 14. "He who is said to Abram after Lot had separated from him." So Lot's on his own little journey now. God takes Abram in this moment of probably sorrow that he's not going to see his nephew on a regular basis anymore, that he's gone a different route. So there's a little bit of sadness there, perhaps. He says to him, "Lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward, westward." So at Bethel, you would be, Abram would be in a good location to look at all of the surrounding territory of Canaan and be told this. Verse 15, "For all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your seed forever." Now, the seed there, according to the Apostle Paul, is ultimately Jesus Christ. So even though the land of Canaan will be given by God to the Israeli people, and it remains, I believe, their heritage, ultimately, Jesus is the one that owns the promised land, not the individual Israelis. In fact, when the Israelis go into the promised land in the story of the Exodus, in the story of Joshua, they are reminded that the land belongs to God. They are only tenants because Jesus owns the land. keep that in mind the next time you have a discussion about to whom the promised land belongs. So to your seed forever. Verse 16, I will make your seed as dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your seed also can be counted. So this is one of the places where we clearly understand that the word seed is the collective singular, the idea of multiple descendants. And an idiomatic expression is used here. If you would like to sit down and try to count all the grains of dust, well, you'd have the same attitude about trying to count how many people are coming from Abram or the sand on the seashore. It's just too much to bother with counting. Bunches. And that would include, by the way, all of us Gentiles who embrace the faith of Jesus Christ, because we became the seed of Abraham because of our faith. So we'd get counted in this monster number. Verse 17, arise, walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. So this will belong to your seed, your descendants. Abram, get used to the territory. And so, in the course of time, Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron, and there he built an altar to He Who Is. So he now takes his Bedouin tent city and goes several days south till he comes to a place that will eventually be named Hebron. It isn't now. Where he finds some Hittites of similar attitudes to himself, and he becomes friends with them and sets up a new worship site and a new tent city. And this will become his major home in the rest of the story of Abram. Have a great weekend. I'll see you next time we get into God's Word.